Since then, there have been a series of other changes in the U.S. policy, but it's still very much up for grabs. It's an ongoing fight in the Congress. Last fall, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee unanimously passed a measure called the Feingold Amendment, sponsored by Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, which would affect the U.S. weapons sales to Indonesia. It would condition them on human rights improvements in East Timor. Even though it unanimously passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, it was blocked from reaching the floor by intense lobbying by the weapons makers and other U.S. multinationals that do business with the Suharto regime. But the issue is still alive in the Congress, and it will be coming up again this spring. Now, as these debates were going on in Washington, the Suharto regime was looking on with great anxiety, because they knew that for years the U.S. government had been their sponsor, their patron, their lifeline. And they knew that if the U.S. turned around on the Timor issue, that this would probably be the beginning of the end of their illegal occupation. And to understand why that's the case, you have to look back at the history. In 1975, on the weekend of December 5th, 1975, President Ford and Henry Kissinger were on a tour through Asia. They flew into Jakarta to meet with Suharto. Suharto was eagerly anticipating this visit, because for a year, he and his military had been planning the invasion of East Timor. Now, for 400 years, Timor had been a colony of Portugal. But after 1974, when Portugal had its own democratic revolution and fascism fell in Portugal and Portugal started to pull out of its colonies, including East Timor started to move toward independence. The major political parties that emerged there all favored independence. The only thing they disagreed on was what the timetable should be and how it should be moved toward. And although the Suharto regime had been quite content with when Timor was a colony of Portugal, they were very nervous about the idea of Timor becoming independent. Now, Timor was a very small place, just 1/200th the population of Indonesia, occupying half an island. But it was the idea of independence which the Suharto government saw as threatening. They thought that the idea of independence and liberty might prove contagious, that it might spread to the population of Indonesia itself, and the people might get ideas if they saw their Timorese neighbors suddenly allowed to freely govern themselves. And so the army recommended to Suharto, as far back as August of 1974, that they go in and take East Timor by force. And we know in great detail the internal machinations that went on, because the CIA and DIA cables from this period were later leaked and published. And Suharto was receptive to the idea of seizing East Timor, but he had one great reservation. And that was, he wanted to be sure how Washington would react to this. At the time, 90% of Indonesia's weapons were supplied by the United States. And he wanted to make sure that in no way would this action offend Washington. So he basically turned to the United States and asked permission to invade East Timor. From the U.S. point of view, the U.S., apparently, from what I've been able to learn by looking at the documents and talking to former officials, didn't feel strongly one way or the other about Timor per se. The CIA had written an internal report a couple years before saying Timor was of no strategic significance. But the U.S. was very close to Suharto. Suharto was a good friend and client of Washington. And so the basic attitude in Washington was, well, if Suharto wants to do it, we'll let him go ahead, basically as a favor. But the one thing that the U.S. asked of Suharto was that he go in quickly with overwhelming force to get this over with fast before it attracted international attention. So Ford and Kissinger met with Suharto on the evening of December 5th and on the morning of December 6th, 1975. And 16 hours after that final meeting, the planes were in the air and the ships began bombarding Dili from offshore. And the paratroopers dropped from the American C-130 planes and landed on the the beach at Dili. Some of the first paratroops to land actually landed on the shore right outside the Motael church, and one of the first to die in the invasion was a man who was shot near the steps of the church. And as the invading force swept inland into Dili, they pulled people from their homes and brought them down to the harbor. They lined them up along the harbor and lined them up along the Arya Branca white sand beach, which sits at the foot of some spectacular cliffs, and they shot them into the sea using freshly delivered American M16s and machine guns, many of which had come in just in the previous few months. And they made a point of finding anyone who had a leadership role in Timorese society. Among those they executed in those first hours were Borja da Costa, Timor's leading poet, Rosa Maria Bonaparte, the founder of the Timorese Women's League, the wife of the Prime Minister of East Timor, basically anyone of social organizational standing they could find. They also shot many people down at random in the streets. And as these executions were going on, President Ford was in the air flying up to Manila to meet with Marcos, Ferdinand Marcos. And the U.S. was announcing that it was doubling its military aid to Indonesia. And also, meanwhile, at the United Nations, where a resolution was being prepared by the Security Council, the resolution which would call upon Indonesia to withdraw its forces without delay, the U.S. was working to see that nothing was done about that resolution. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. at the time, and he later boasted in his memoirs that his instructions from the State Department were to see to it that the U.N. prove utterly ineffective in any action it might undertake on East Timor. And he said, I carried that mission forward with no inconsiderable success. So you had the U.S. giving the go-ahead, sending in the weapons, blocking the U.N. from taking action, and the slaughter proceeded. The army swept in from Dili and from Baucau. They went in massacring village by village. But the army found, when they got into many villages, that there were no more Timorese. Many of the people had fled and gone up into the hills. Timor has a very rugged, mountainous interior. Many had taken guns left over from the Portuguese period and were attempting to mount a guerrilla resistance. And a full year after the invasion, the army still found that more than half of the Timorese population was beyond their reach. They literally could not physically get their hands on them because they were still at large in the hills. And it was at this point, at the end of the Ford and the beginning of the Jimmy Carter administration, that the U.S. sent in planes and helicopters, OV-10 Bronco planes specially designed for flying in low over the treetops, and helicopters which are used for bombing and strafing. And using these freshly supplied American aircraft, the Indonesian troops bombed and strafed the Timorese down from the hills and herded them into prison and resettlement camps. At one point in 1978, the Indonesian Defense Ministry actually published official statistics indicating that more than half of the surviving Timorese population was interned in these camps. In these camps, they implemented a policy of enforced starvation, where food and water were withheld from those who did not bend to the wishes of the army. And tens of thousands died within a matter of weeks and months. Many had died in the hills as they were being bombed and strafed. They would flee for hours and hours, days and days, not having time to pause and gather food. I talked to one woman who spoke of tripping over bodies as they were running, and how they would have to leave people behind as they fell. And one man who described how he could see the face of the pilot as he came in overhead, and seeing someone be disemboweled by the shrapnel from one of the bombs dropped from one of the American planes. And as all this was going on, the U.S., this was under Carter now, was still shipping in the new aircraft, still providing the political cover at the U.N. to make this mass murder possible. Now, this continued year after year through the occupation and genocide, through the Carter administration, through the Reagan administration, through the Bush administration. And during this time, the Indonesian military was slowly establishing what attempts to be a totalitarian regime in Timor, where the army, attempts to watch everyone on a 24-hour basis. People to this day in many regions of Timor are still prohibited from going out to work their fields on the hillsides because the army is afraid, and we know this from their internal intelligence manuals which have leaked, that if people go out into the fields, they'll start talking among themselves and plotting among the army, so they have to be kept in close to the bases and close to the roadsides where the army can keep them under 24-hour watch. And when I first visited Timor in August of 1990, I was struck by the atmosphere there. I had spent many years in places like Guatemala, El Salvador, the Israeli-occupied West Bank, South Africa, I mean, some of the most repressive places on earth. But I have to say that I never saw a place where the authorities had succeeded in making quite so many people quite so terrified. The people at every level of Timorese society knew that they could be killed or tortured by the army at any moment. Even the Bishop of Timor physically feared for his safety. Even the Indonesian-appointed governor of Timor felt the same way. I had an interview with the governor. He's a Timorese national who became a collaborator of the Indonesian military and was on their payroll as governor. And I went to see him in his vast, luxurious governor's mansion. And I had heard about all these torture houses and had put together a lot of very specific information about them, so I thought I would confront him with this information. And I asked him about this one place in particular. It's called the Hotel Flamboyant. It's actually a tourist hotel in Baucau, the second city of East Timor, which is also used as a torture center. And so I said, are there prisoners being tortured in the Hotel Flamboyant? And to my amazement, he said, oh, yeah, of course there are. And he said, as a matter of fact, my wife and I visited there not long ago, and we actually videotaped, and he gave a figure, it was 90-something prisoners who were being held and tortured. This is according to Governor Karaskalau at that time, the Indonesian-appointed governor of Timor. And he went on to talk in some detail about the torture houses in Dili and throughout the rest of the country. And I was a little amazed that he was so open about this. But the point he was making, that he was trying to say that when Timorese, he said he would get lots and lots of letters from Timorese who would write to him when one of their relatives was disappeared by the army, and he would try to put in a good word on their behalf with the army in hopes that the army wouldn't kill them or torture them to death. So I asked him, well, have you ever tried to visit one of these torture houses? Have you ever actually tried to go inside and see what was happening? And he looked at me with amazement when I said that, and he said, you know, you've got to be kidding. I'm only the governor of East Timor. I mean, if I try to go into one of these places, some soldier could shoot me down. Even he lived with the knowledge that his life was in the hands of the army, and it could be taken at any moment. So this is the context in which the Dili massacre happened, a regime of utter terror, but which people with just tremendous courage and persistence have resisted. But one of the most striking things about Timor, when I first got there, I realized that as a foreigner just walking through the streets, the Timorese would look to you as a conduit to the outside world. So people would sidle up to you on the street and looking around very nervously when they thought a soldier or a secret policeman wasn't looking, they would whisper, they'll kill me if they see us talking. It is prohibited to speak to tourists, but they killed my father, they killed my brother, they killed my sisters. Please get a message to the President of the United States or the Secretary General of the UN or the Prime Minister of Australia. And often they would hand you notes and say, please deliver this to the President or please deliver this to the Secretary General. Or they would hand you lists of members of their family who had been killed. And this would happen place after place and village after village. And it gave the sensation of, it reminded me of people putting a note in a bottle and just casting it out onto the waves in hopes that it would wash up on shore somewhere and somebody would read it and come to their aid. They just somehow wanted to get word of what was happening to the outside world. And in a way, in a very bitter way, the people who gave their lives on November 12th did succeed in that to some extent, because that massacre, because it was survived and witnessed by foreigners, did generate some international attention. And the people who are working here today in this country to try to change the criminal participation of the United States in this killing really carry with them, to some extent, the legacy of those who died on November 12th. As we were leaving that day, somebody, a prominent Timorese, said to us, "The United States is the key. The United States holds the key to all of this, because the United States is the sponsor behind it. And please try to tell people in the United States what is happening here. I mean, that is our, that's our hope." And I think that Americans who hear about this, who get the facts of this situation, and who happen to disagree with this kind of torture and mass slaughter of people whose only crime is that they want to be able to govern themselves. What they're asking for concretely, very specifically, is the right to self-determination, which the Security Council resolutions say they're entitled to, a free election where they can choose their own form of government. Only Americans can stop that trigger from being pulled. There were many people who worked very hard in this country to stop U.S. backing of the slaughter in Guatemala and Salvador and Nicaragua. And although I think the people who worked here on those issues did succeed in saving hundreds, perhaps thousands of lives by restraining the U.S. actions at the margin and by working on individual cases and preserving the lives of individual prisoners and people who'd been disappeared and doing things like blocking the shipment of helicopter spare parts to Guatemala for a period of about 5 years, meaning that those helicopters were not in the air strafing villages, and probably stopping the U.S. from staging an all-out invasion of El Salvador at the time it was considering that when Alexander Haig was the Secretary of State. By doing these things, people who were active in this country undoubtedly saved many lives, and there are many people who are walking around in Central America today who would not be had it not been for that kind of activism. But unfortunately, they were not able to change the course of the U.S. policy, and the slaughter continued and does continue to this day in those countries. But now in East Timor, there is an opportunity to actually change the course of the policy. There is a pitched battle going on in Washington at this moment over this issue. In a way, the grassroots movement stole a march on the multinationals and on the career people in the Pentagon and the State Department and caught them unaware and were able to push through this cutoff of the military training aid to Indonesia and were able to pressure the State Department to block a shipment of F-5 fighter planes to Indonesia last summer and pressure the U.S. into changing its stance at the UN Human Rights Commission and making a number of other important policy changes. But now the corporations and the weapons makers and the people in the State Department, the Pentagon, have begun to fight back. They've gotten themselves organized. And for example, they've now gotten the White House. President Clinton has now decided to continue the military training of Indonesian troops using this rather ingenious loophole. What the Congress did was they cut off the U.S. funds for training the Indonesian troops. Now the U.S. is continuing to provide the training as long as Indonesia pays for it. So Indonesia, the Indonesian government simply lays out the cash and the training continues, an end run around congressional intent. The U.S. continues to ship weapons, new M-16s, new weapon systems of all sorts at the rate of a shipment about every week or two, a fresh shipment. This continues even in the wake of the Dili massacre. So at this moment, the battle over policy is very much contested. It's very much up in the air, and it could go either way. This spring, there will probably be a measure similar to the Feingold Amendment introduced in the House And it really does depend on us. I mean, occasionally, I've been banned from returning to Indonesia as a threat to national security, and can't return to East Timor as long as the army continues to occupy it. But I still get messages out from the Timorese, and they monitor with great care what happens here in the U.S. And even though it is prohibited for the Timorese to listen to the foreign shortwave radio broadcasts, if you're caught listening to BBC Radio Netherlands, you can be hauled away to a torture house. They listen to them anyway. And word passes from one to another about what's happened. And whenever word comes through about a new development in Washington, like the cutoff of military training aid or the Foreign Relations Committee vote on the Hatfield Amendment, what I hear from people there is that it just sends tremendous waves of excitement and hope through the population, because they realize how important that is. They realize how decisive it is. And the Timorese have also seen how the efforts in the wake of the massacre have begun to strike a chord within Indonesia itself. Because we should remember that just as the people of East Timor live under horrible repression by the Indonesian army, so does the population of Indonesia itself. Indonesians put their freedom and their lives on the line when they try to speak out against the Suharto dictatorship, but many have done so nonetheless. Just this past fall, there was a very important demonstration of young people in front of the parliament where they actually dared, and this is extremely bold in Indonesia, to say that President Suharto himself should be put on trial for his crimes. And they talked about his responsibility for the massacres of the Indonesian citizens when Suharto and the army first came to power in 65, 66, 67, were anywhere from 400,000 to a million Indonesian civilians, many members of the Indonesian Communist Party or anyone else who was perceived as an opponent of the army, many ethnic Chinese, were executed en masse by Suharto's forces. Other massacres against the internal Indonesian population, and also the Dili massacre of Timorese. These Indonesian students and young people were specifically raising these issues, saying Suharto should be put on trial. They were, of course, immediately seized, taken away, tortured by the police. Just recently, one of the leading, most respected sociologists in Indonesia, Dr. George Ajichandro, spoke out very boldly and published articles about the policy of repression in East Timor, talking in concrete terms about the invasion, the massacre of East Timor. Since then, he's been under terrible threat. His house was stoned. The head of his university has said he doesn't know if he'll be able to withstand the army pressure to try to get him fired. His wife has been receiving threats. He's living on the edge right now. But these are the kind of chords that have been struck among the Indonesian population as a result of the organizing that has happened in the wave of the Dili massacre, and this is all quite significant. I mean, this bodes well for the future of the Timorese. It's what gives them hope, even in the face of the continued killing and torture. But all recognize that it's the United States that holds the key. It's the United States that can stop the shipment of weapons and can give the go-ahead to the UN to proceed with seriously attempting to enforce those Security Council resolutions. And finally, I just say that, you know, remember, this isn't East Timor. It's not as if, well, first of all, a meeting like this would be impossible in Timor. Any gathering like this is prohibited. Any discussion of politics is prohibited. Certainly any criticism of the state is prohibited. In Timor, if someone is considering becoming politically active, the questions they have to ask themselves are, do I really want to risk the life of my family? Do I want to take the chance that they might, abduct my parents or my husband or my wife if I take this step? Can I really face being tortured? I mean, do I really want to be there in the room with the colonel from Intel who brings the razor blade up to my eye? Can I handle that? That's the question you have to ask yourself in Timor if you're considering becoming active. We don't have to ask ourselves that question. Here, the question you have to ask yourself is, well, do I really want to place that phone call to the office of the senator? Do I really want to sit down and take half an hour to write and mail that letter? Do I really want to spend the 2 hours a month or every 2 weeks to go to the meeting? Do I really want to spend a few hours on the phone organizing other people? Those are the choices we confront, and clearly there's no comparison. You know, we don't face the same kind of risks. For us, it's a matter of expending a little time, a little effort. So I'll just close by noting again that the Timorese are doing all they can, but they're on the other end of the gun. We're on the trigger end, and only we can stop it. Thanks.
That was Alan Nairn on East Timor, a case of genocide. He spoke in Portland, Oregon on April 1, 1994. Since then, East Timor has been much in the news. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit was held in Indonesia in November. In full media view, a group of East Timorese with banners demanding independence sat in at the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta. In East Timor itself, widespread demonstrations protesting Indonesian rule broke out. On November 12th, the third anniversary of the Dili massacre, Alan Nairn and his colleague Amy Goodman were arrested and detained as they attempted to legally enter East Timor. Eventually, they secretly visited the island. On November 19th, Indonesia banned all foreign journalists from entering East Timor. At an APEC press conference, President Clinton, while not calling for self-determination, said that the people of East Timor should have more say over their own local affairs. He reportedly discussed the issue with Indonesian President Suharto. East Timor is at a turning point. Now that APEC has ended and the potentates and media have left, the Indonesian military has stepped up repression. For information on what you can do, call the East Timor Action Network in White Plains, New York. The number is 914-428-7299. Again, that's 914-428-7299. For information on getting copies of this program, you can call 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Printed transcripts of Alan Nairn on East Timor, A Case of Genocide, are $7. Cassettes are $11. Please send your check to Alternative Radio, 2129 Mapleton, Boulder, Colorado, 80304. Again, transcripts are $7. Cassettes are $11. The address, Alternative Radio, 2129 Mapleton, Boulder, Colorado, 80304. Thanks to Will Seaman for recording the program. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you very much.